Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing something really interesting, I think. We're trying to sort of crack open the black box of our modern digital world.
Yeah, that black box being cryptography.
Exactly. We're diving into cryptography using Panos Lourdes's work as our guide, trying to understand the invisible math that pretty much secures everything we do online.
And it's so important, you know, because people hear cryptography and they think, oh, spies maybe, or really dense academic papers.
Right, something totally separate from everyday life.
But Lourdes argues very convincingly, I think, that it's absolutely not niche anymore. It's the basic pervasive plumbing underneath online banking, our emails, our messages, even our digital identity.
So understanding it is kind of essential for just being literate in the digital age.
That's exactly his point.
Yeah.
Digital literacy requires knowing at least the basics here.
Okay. I like that framing. It makes it feel much more relevant. So tell us a bit about Panos Lourdes. What's his background? What makes his take on this, well, unique?
Well, he's in a really interesting spot to tackle this. He's a professor of software engineering at Athens University of Economics and Business. So he definitely knows the theory.
Okay, the academic side.
But crucially, he's also a practitioner. He's involved with GRNET, that's the Greek National Research and Technology Network.
Ah, so he's not just talking about it. He's actually involved in building and running the systems that depend on this stuff.
Exactly. And that dual perspective, I think, is key. It means his book doesn't just get lost in, you know, super abstract math that most of us can't follow.
Yeah.
He connects those deep mathematical ideas to the real world, things like digital rights, economic security, privacy, the societal stuff.
So his goal isn't to turn us all into mathematicians.
No, not at all. It's really about demystifying it. He wants to show that you don't need, like, a PhD to get the core principles.
Making it out of that black box, like we said.
Yeah, showing the logic behind it, how it creates trust, almost like, you know, basic economics or law principles create trust in other areas.
Okay, that leads us nicely into the book's core idea then. Lourdes seems to frame cryptography as the answer to this huge problem of trust online.
Yes, because the digital world is fundamentally trustless, isn't it? Information is so easy to copy, to change, to intercept.
Right. When I log into my bank, how do I know it's really my bank? How do I know the numbers I'm seeing haven't been fiddled with?
Exactly. Or sending a message, is it going to the right person? Can someone else read it? These are the basic problems.
And cryptography provides the mathematical structure for that trust.
Precisely. It's the framework that lets us have privacy and integrity, even when we're dealing with total strangers online. It protects individuals, sure, but it also makes the whole, you know, multi-trillion-dollar digital economy even possible.
Without it, the whole thing collapses.
Lourdes argues, yeah, it just wouldn't exist as we know it.
Okay, so let's dig into how this developed. The book starts with history, right? This kind of arms race.
Yeah, it's always been this back and forth. Codemakers versus codebreakers. It's a classic story.
Like the Caesar cipher. Just shifting letters.
Exactly. Super simple substitution. Shift the alphabet, you know, three letters over, whatever. Worked for Caesar for a bit.
But not for long, I gather.
No, because people figured out frequency analysis. You just look at which letters appear most often. In English, E is super common, Z is rare.
Ah, okay. So you look for the most frequent symbol in the coded message, assume it's E, and work from there.
That's the basic idea. And that simple technique basically broke centuries of codes. It forced innovation.
Which eventually leads us to modern stuff.
Right. Fast forward quite a bit and you get to modern symmetric cryptography. This is the workhorse today. Things like AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard.
AES, I've heard of that. That's for encrypting lots of data quickly.
Yeah, incredibly powerful, very efficient. Think of it like having a single shared secret key for a strong box. You and I both have the same key. I lock the box, send it to you, you unlock it. Great for big files, streaming video, that kind of thing.
But there's a catch, right?
Always a catch. The massive, age-old problem, key distribution. How do we securely share that secret key in the first place?
Especially for strangers, maybe on opposite sides of the world. And the only way to communicate is, well, insecure.
Precisely. How do you get the key across without someone intercepting it? This was the roadblock for thousands of years, and understanding that problem is really key to seeing why the next step was such a revolution.
Okay, but hold on. Before we get to that big breakthrough, Larie talks about something else, right? Something that isn't about hiding things.
Yes. Cryptographic hashes. This is a shift in focus from secrecy, confidentiality to integrity, making sure things haven't been tampered with.
Okay, so what is a hash?
Think of it like a unique digital fingerprint or a digest. You feed any data, a whole book, an email, even one word, into a hash function.
And it spits out a short code.
A short fixed size code, yeah. And it's unique to that input. Change one comma in the book, you get a totally different hash.
What makes them special?
Two crucial things. First, they're one way. Easy to calculate the hash from the message, but practically impossible to go the other way to figure out the message just from the hash.
Right.
Second, they're collision resistant. It's incredibly hard, basically impossible, to find two different messages that produce the exact same hash fingerprint.
And this is used for passwords. So websites don't store my actual password.
Exactly. They store the hash of your password. So if their database gets hacked, the attackers get the hashes, which are useless for logging in because they're one way.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. It protects the data's integrity, or in this case, protects the original password.
Right. So hashes for integrity. Now we can talk about the really big leap. Public key cryptography,
yeah,
also called asymmetric.
This is the game changer. The Diffie-Hellman-Merkle stuff, RSA. This basically enabled the modern internet, didn't it?
Absolutely monumental. It solved that key distribution problem elegantly. Instead of one shared secret key, everyone gets a pair of keys mathematically linked. A public key you can share with anyone, post it on your website, whatever.
Okay.
And a private key that you guard, like your life depends on it. Never share it.
Oh. How does that help send a secret message?
Well, if I want to send you a secret message, I find your public key. Anyone can have it. I use that public key to encrypt the message.
Okay.
But here's the magic. Because of the mathematical link, only your corresponding private key can decrypt that message. Nobody else's. Not even the public key that locked it.
Wow. So the key used to lock it can't unlock it.
Correct. Only the private key can. So you solve the key distribution problem because the public key can be shared openly, even shouted from the rooftops. The encryption happens in full view of the enemy, as they say.
That's brilliant. And it relies on hard math problems.
Yes. What Lourdes calls trapdoor functions. Things that are easy to do one way, but incredibly hard to reverse unless you have the secret trapdoor information, the private key.
Like multiplying two huge prime numbers is easy.
But factoring the result back into the original primes is astronomically hard for classical computers if the numbers are big enough. That's the basis of RSA.
So our online security rests on difficult math homework.
Essentially, yes. Billions of dollars flow based on the difficulty of factoring large numbers.
Okay, so that handles secrecy.
Yeah.
But these keys can do more, right? Signatures.
Exactly. Digital signatures. Here, you kind of flip the process. You take your message, or more often, the hash of your message.
Using the fingerprint thing we talked about.
Right. And you use your private key to sign that hash.
Okay, so I sign it with my secret key.
Mm.
What does that achieve?
Anyone with your public key can then verify that signature. And it proves two things. One, authentication, it really came from you because only you have the private key to create that specific signature.
Okay. Proof of origin.
And two, non-repudiation and integrity. It proves the message hasn't been changed since you signed it because if it had, the hash would be different and the signature wouldn't match.
Got it. So you can prove who sent it and that it's unaltered.
Yes. But this creates a new problem, especially at internet scale.
Which is?
If I download a public key that claims to belong to my bank, how do I really know it's the bank's key and not some scammer's key? Public keys are just data.
Ah, right. The trust problem pops up again, just in a different place. How do we trust the keys themselves?
Exactly. And the answer is this whole infrastructure called PKI, public key infrastructure. And within that, you have certificate authorities, or CAs.
CAs. I've heard of those. They're like digital notaries.
Sort of, yeah. They are trusted third parties whose job is to verify identities, like really check that Amazon is Amazon, and then issue a digital certificate. This certificate essentially binds the public key to that verified identity.
So my browser trusts a few major CAs,
mm-hmm.
and when I visit my bank's website, the bank presents its certificate signed by a CA my browser trusts.
Right. And because your browser trusts the CA, it can then trust that the public key and the certificate really belongs to the bank. It creates a chain of trust.
And that little padlock icon in my browser address bar,
yeah,
that's basically signaling that this whole PKICA check happened successfully.
That's exactly what it signifies. It's the visual cue that this trust system is working behind the scenes.
Okay, wow. So we have symmetric keys for speed, asymmetric keys for secure key exchange and signatures, hashes for integrity, and PKICAs for trusting the keys.
Yeah.
How does it all come together? Lourdes talks about a cryptographic dance.
Yeah, the TLS-SSL handshake. That's what happens every time you connect to a secure website, like with HTTPS. It cleverly combines the different tools.
Right, because the asymmetric stuff is secure but kind of slow, and the symmetric stuff is fast but has that key sharing problem.
Precisely. So step one, you connect. Your browser and the server use the slow but secure public key crypto. Asymmetric using the PKI certificates just for that initial handshake.
What happens during the handshake?
They verify each other's identity using the certificates, and crucially, they securely negotiate a temporary one-time use symmetric key, a shared secret just for this session.
Ah, so they use the slow method just to agree on a fast key.
Exactly. That's step two. Once they have that shared symmetric key, like an AES key, they immediately switch to using the fast symmetric encryption for all the actual data. The web pages, your login info, everything.
Clever.
And step three, throughout the whole session, hash functions are working in the background, constantly checking the integrity of the data packets being sent back and forth, making sure nothing got corrupted or sneakily modified midstream.
So it's not just one algorithm, it's a layered protocol, a sequence of steps using different tools for different jobs.
Perfectly put. It's a protocol, an elegant dance.
And this whole field just keeps evolving, right?
Yeah.
The arms race continues.
Absolutely. Lourdes touches on this too. You see these cryptographic primitives, hashes, signatures being used in new ways, like in blockchain.
Right. Bitcoin and others rely heavily on hashes and digital signatures.
They do. And then there's the big shadow looming over everything, quantum computing.
The potential game changer. Why is it such a threat?
Because the very math that makes RSA secure the difficulty of factoring large numbers is something that a powerful enough quantum computer could theoretically solve very quickly.
So it breaks the foundation of much of our current public key crypto.
It threatens to, yes, which is why there's a huge global effort right now to develop and standardize post-quantum cryptography, new algorithms based on different kinds of math problems that even quantum computers would struggle with. The race is definitely on.
Wow. Okay, so the tech is complex, constantly changing, but Lourdes really emphasizes the bigger picture, the human side. What are the core themes we should take away?
I think theme one is really powerful, seeing cryptography as democratic infrastructure. It's not just tech. It's what protects the private space needed for free thought, for organizing, for dissent. You know, it shields activists and ordinary citizens from pervasive surveillance.
So privacy isn't about hiding wrongdoing. It's about enabling freedom.
That's a key part of his argument, yeah. Then theme two is how it's become the invisible foundation of modern life, like electricity or plumbing.
You don't think about it, but everything depends on it.
Exactly. Every time you message someone, buy something online, check your bank balance, there's this incredibly complex symphony of cryptographic security making it possible, and we just take it for granted.
And the third theme.
That perpetual arms race we mentioned. It's never done. Code breakers find a new attack, so code makers have to improve the algorithms or protocols. Frequency analysis broke simple ciphers. Enigma needed complex machines. Now we're looking at post-quantum. It's constant evolution driven by threats.
The book seems full of these really potent ideas, sometimes just stated very simply.
Oh, definitely. One that really sticks out is cryptography is not just about keeping secrets. It's about enabling trust in a trustless world.
That completely reframes it, doesn't it?
Right.
It's not just about hiding things. It's about creating the conditions for safe interaction.
Right. It explains how we can have global e-commerce, how strangers can securely transact. We trust the math, not necessarily the person. The math guarantees certain properties like authenticity and integrity.
Yeah, I like that. What's another key idea?
How about this one? The invention of public key cryptography was as revolutionary for digital communication as the printing press was for the spread of knowledge.
That's a bold claim, but it makes sense when you think about it. The printing press let information spread widely. Public key crypto lets secure communication happen between any two people on Earth instantly without needing some prior secret arrangement.
It decentralized security in a way. A massive shift.
Okay. And maybe one more. Something about the civic angle.
Yes, that crucial point. Privacy is not about having something to hide. It's about preserving the space for individual thought and democratic participation.
That directly counters the argument you sometimes hear. You know, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. from surveillance or weak encryption.
Exactly. It frames privacy as a collective good, essential for a healthy democracy, not just an individual preference for secrecy.
So bringing this all back to the listener, after this deep dive, how does understanding this stuff actually empower you, sitting there listening right now?
Well, first, you get a real feel for what end-to-end encryption means. When Signal or WhatsApp says your messages are end-to-end encrypted,
you now know it means they're likely using that public-private key system, so only the sender and receiver can read it, not the company, not anyone in the middle.
Exactly. Which might make you think harder about which apps you trust with your conversations.
Okay, that's practical. What else?
Second, it helps with policy and civic participation. When politicians talk about needing back doors into encryption to catch criminals,
you understand that deliberately weakening the math, for one reason, weakens it for everyone, for your bank account, for dissidents overseas, for critical infrastructure. It's not a surgical tool.
Right. You can engage with those debates from a more informed standpoint beyond just the sort of political soundbites.
Good point. And a third application.
Just becoming a more critical evaluator of the digital world, instead of passively accepting claims about security, you can ask smarter questions. Like, okay, you say it's secure, but how? Are you using standard algorithms like AES? How are the keys managed? Is there third-party verification? Okay. Become a more active questioning participant.
Not just a passive user.
Precisely. You know, thinking about the whole book, what surprised me most, perhaps, was just how effectively humanity has used abstract mathematics, really quite deep, complex math, to solve very concrete, very social and economic problems. Problems of trust, identity, commerce. It's kind of amazing.
Yes, pure logic creating a social reality.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the big takeaway is that paradigm shift Lourdes pushes for.
Mm.
We really have to stop seeing encryption as some niche technical tool for spies or geeks.
Mm-hmm.
It is the fundamental infrastructure. It dictates the rules of the road for our entire digital civilization. It shapes what's possible, what's safe, what's private online. Understanding it is understanding a core part of the 21st century.
Well said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Decatra Foundation.